There you go. First of all, just a little housekeeping announcement. There is an old Mercedes car in the car park up above. It's the one which is furthest from the cottages. The door is open. So if that's yours, please close it. Otherwise, you're inviting everybody to go inside, have a look, and maybe have a test drive. Very good. So the questions, here we go. Does sex put a constraint on one's meditation progress? No, because we've all got a sex. I'm a male, you're a female. So there's no constraint at all. Now, as long as you don't do any while you're here, then you should be fine. I think, Jimmy, the practice. Because what happens, look, seriously, part of the meditation is just letting go of the body. So you can really get into the mind, the sixth sense. And when you start getting into bodily stuff, now you actually get sort of, the body gets very strong, and it's very hard to let it go. So that's why we have eight precepts while you're here. So the eighth precept, the third precept is avoid all sorts of sex, no hanky-panky. It's only for 8 days, come on. So that means you can actually just let go of seeking for pleasure in the body and you get much more pleasure in the mind. So that's why we have a little bit of celibacy while you're in the monastery or when you're in the retreat, because it actually does assist the meditation. So you're not thinking about sex, you're not thinking about girls and boys, or boys and boys, or girls and girls, or boys and cats. I don't know what you think about these days. Yeah, it's really, really difficult to know what's going on. But anyway, you know that you can actually have a nice, peaceful life there. And it's also, if you start having that sort of stuff, you're going to make enormous noise in the cottage. So please, out of concern for others, please keep it quiet. What else about it? So just try and keep it nice and simple. And it's only, people actually say that if you're like playing sort of top sports, like football or cricket or something, all the top sportsmen, they don't have sex the night before, because they found out actually it does actually affect their performance the next day. So if you are going for enlightenment tomorrow morning, no sex tonight. Anyway, next question. I feel very composed and happy when I do meditation. I am practicing and cultivating wisdom and strength. But, why we got that word, but? I'm going to stop there. Next question. No, I've got to answer the questions. A real battle world, at work or with family and friends, I have the moments when I feel stressed or embarrassed and I can't put myself together. Is there any quick practical tips I can use at these situations? Yes, when you get stressed out at work or with family, just find a nice quiet place just to regroup, to do a bit of meditation, present moment awareness and just a bit of silence. Just watch your breath, breathing in peace, breathe out, let go. And the best place to find that in your house or in your office is the toilet. You can lock yourself in there, and doesn't matter how long you spend in there, people will let you spend as much as you need. And if there's any problem, you say, I'm constipated. And you're not lying, because you are mentally constipated. So you can spend in there until you're nice and free and you feel relaxed. And it's well worth doing, because if you stay there with a bad mind, you can say all sorts of stupid things, bad things, which you regret afterwards. And if you want to know, okay, I can't resist the stories. There was this man who came to the temple one evening. And he came there because he'd been thrown out of the house by his wife. He said something really terrible to his wife, and his wife said, get out of here, you can't stay here tonight. So he went to the temple and asked to stay there. And he asked the monk, is there anything I can do, to overcome this problem? Because, I'd said something really bad to my wife. And the monk said, there is a Buddhist ceremony which especially works when people have said something bad to their husband or bad to their wife. He said it's called the chicken ceremony. How many of you heard of that in Buddhism, the chicken ceremony? So he said, obviously I need a chicken to do the chicken ceremony. So he said, there's still enough time, just go to the market and get me a chicken. You know, a dead one, obviously. And on the way, you know, to save some time, on the way from the market back to the temple, you know, pluck the feathers out, because I need the chicken, you know, freshly plucked. So he ran to the market, managed to get a chicken before they closed up, because it was getting late. And he walked back to the temple, on the way, plucked the feathers out. And he gave the monk the chicken. He said, thank you very much. The second part of the ceremony is tomorrow morning, so you can stay here overnight. So the man stayed there overnight, and the following morning, so the monk got the chicken out of the freezer and said, okay, for the second part of the ceremony, I need all those feathers back, so go back the way you came, collect all the feathers, and put them back in the chicken where you took them out from. He said, are you crazy? You can't do that. I don't know even if I can find all the feathers, you know, if I chucked them away yesterday. And even so, I can't stick them back in once they've been taken out. And the monk said, yes, that is the meaning of the chicken ceremony. You can't sort of put a feather back into a chicken once you've taken it out. Just like once the words have come out of your mouth, you can't catch them and put them back in again. That is the meaning of the chicken ceremony. So be more careful next time what you say, because once that word comes out, you can't put it back in again. It's out forever. That is the meaning of the chicken ceremony in Buddhism. Very good, yes, I think that's very good too. So be careful what you say. And that means that in the family, you know, sometimes we say silly things. And we have a battle with family and friends. And I remember I did tell you the secret of harmony in a marriage about who's right and who's wrong yesterday, didn't I? If it's an odd day, she's right. If it's an even day, he's right. So it's already settled who's right and who's wrong in a marriage. And it's great, because you don't have to argue then. You just agree with that. And you sign a contract when you first get married, okay, this is what we'll do. So odd days, the girl's right, the wife's right. Even days, the husband's right. And then you can have a very harmonious marriage, because you don't have to argue. The calendar decides it for you. Today is a new moon. Are the phases of the moon any significance in Buddhism? Yes, they are. We always do big ceremonies. New moon is not so powerful, but the full moon is. Because the Buddha got enlightened on the full moon. And usually the full moon is the best time to get enlightened. All the powers are there. So the next time you book into a retreat, check whether there's a full moon in that retreat. And if there is, that increases your chances. But actually, not really. Just, you know, it's sometimes a full moon, it does have some magic to it, especially in the forest. You can just walk anywhere, you don't need a flashlight, and it's just alive all night. So full moons are usually very significant because you feel more energetic on the full moon. But nothing really much. This deep train of thought seems a little beyond me. Excellent. So if the train of thoughts is beyond you, it means you must be beyond the thoughts. You've escaped. Well done. But I don't think that's what they mean. I think their train of thoughts is running over them. Yeah, I'm ashamed to say this as a Buddhist, but present moment, you don't have to be ashamed of anything in Buddhism. You can say whatever you like. You know, we don't have fatwas. Sometimes I wish we had. I know a few people I'd use one on straight away, but we don't have them. So you're pretty safe over here. But anyway, you can say whatever you want. Don't have to be ashamed. But present moment awareness is a new, strange, and scary place. Oh, no, this is a good question. I'm comfortable in my endless barrage of thoughts, often on familiar themes, turning into real-life noise and feelings, etc., like stopping a turning to real-life noise and feelings. Feels like stopping a steam train at full speed. I feel like I'm imprisoned by this habitual distraction of the unending, usually slightly negative world of thoughts. Please help. This is brilliant because, you know, at least you're realizing just, you know, what the problem is. Always thinking, 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 never really being here, you know, in real life. So one little exercise you can do, which is quite powerful, is, but it takes a bit of work, so don't do it too long, otherwise you get tired. Is you take a mantra, and the one which I like to suggest to people is the old Tibetan mantra of Om Mani Padme Hum. Because many of you know that, but how many of you know what it means? Hardly anybody. That's why it works. Because, you know, it's nonsense because you don't know what it means. So you recite that to yourself. Now, Om Mani Padme Hum, Om Mani Padme Hum, silently, not out loud. Om Mani Padme Hum, Om Mani Padme Hum, just gently for 1 minute. And after 1 minute, then you put spaces between the words. Om Mani Padme Hum, Om Mani Padme Hum. And just notice the spaces between the words. And do that for 2 minutes. You don't have to get your clock out, just roughly. And then, for the next 2 minutes, lengthen the spaces between the words. Om Mani Padme Hum. Om Mani. For another couple of minutes. But if a thought comes in that space, close up the space and go back to Om Mani Padme Hum. Om Mani Padme Hum. And so you expand the spaces gradually. And if a thought comes, you close up those spaces. So this way, actually, you're blocking the thoughts out. It's called substitution by the Buddha. You substitute the, you know, the meaningless words for you. It's Buddhist. It means something good. But you don't have to worry what. Om Mani Padme Hum. And then you put spaces in the words, between the words. Om Mani Padme Hum. And expand those spaces slowly. Thought comes in, close them up again. And then expand them until you get used to the spaces. And expand those spaces really long. Om Mani Padme Hum. And the silence, once it starts to extend, it's a beautiful experience to be aware without any thoughts in the head. It's not scary, but it's just so therapeutic, it's so restful. Silence at last between your ears. And once you recognize how delightful is the silence, it stays a long time with you. So that's a very beautiful method if you have a big lot of thoughts in the mind. You change the thoughts over, substitute something, Om Mani Padme Hum, Om Mani Padme Hum. Start the next after 1 minute, put spaces between the words. Lengthen the spaces slowly. Thought comes up, close them up again. Until you can lengthen the spaces, and there's lots of moments of silence. And then you learn how just to be without giving things a name. It's much, much nicer experience. And you find you become wiser, healthier. And because you're silent, the reason why you become wiser is because instead of talking to the world with your thoughts, you're actually listening to the world. You're allowing it to teach you when you're silent. So it gives a really, really strong sense of inner listening to the world. So try that, the Om Mani Padme Hum method. If I'm on 8 precepts, I'm allowed to wear deodorant. It depends how old you are. Old people smell, so certainly yes. It's true! Come on. But anyway, just ask somebody else to give you the smell test. Of course it's okay to wear deodorant, just out of compassion for all other beings. But you don't need to wear Chanel No. 5 or whatever else you know you're wearing, because some of those smells are just really quite oppressive to people. You know, really, really strong smells. So just know enough deodorant to take away bad smells. And always wash and stuff like that. No trouble. Yes, you can wear deodorants. First day, I cherish the time of cultivation. I tried to be mindful at every moment. I felt peaceful, joyful, and admired the beauty of nature. Second day, I think I let go too much. I slept till 5:30 a.m. and had a nap till 3:30 p.m. Sometimes I don't know if I should meditate, work, or explore the nature. I found it's too flexible to settle my mind. Are we indulging ourselves? However, I'm so grateful that you built this nature environment with modern facilities for us. It's like a paradise for me, especially during meditation. Highest respect. Yeah, it is. No, the first few days, you know, just pamper yourselves. So if you do need to sleep, if you sleep till 5:30, or, you know, after lunch you have a nap till 3:30, if you sleep that long, it's because you need it. You know, if you didn't need it, you just, you know, go to bed, and I can't go to sleep, you get up again after 15 minutes or 20 minutes. The fact you can do that means you needed it. So that's no problem at all the first two or three days. So you can let go and you feel so much better. There's many more days to go, so you just prepare the body so it's nice and rested, it feels really good. Now please remember again that story of the Buddha, because he had his first five disciples, and when the Buddha started relaxing, his five disciples thought he'd given up the practice, he wasn't trying anymore, they thought he was slacking off, and that's why they abandoned him. It was only later on that, you know, they found out that it actually worked, you know, he became the Buddha. So there's something really important in looking after your body. And I don't know why it is in many religions, they always think you can conquer your body by willpower. And just get up early. 5 o'clock, that's for namby-pambies. 4 o'clock, now, that's just for ordinary people. If you want to get enlightened, get up at 3 o'clock and don't go to bed until 2:30 a.m. Then you're going to get enlightened. Yeah, I've seen people do stuff like that, and I used to do stuff like that, and it doesn't work. It just makes you all tense and very angry and makes you sick after a while. So whoever wrote this, you're doing well. Just quite naturally that, you know, that you will just want to get up early in the morning. You just wake up and you feel good, so you just go and meditate. And you don't need a nap in the afternoon because you're rested, because you're not doing anything here. So after a while, especially when you stop thinking too much, you stop worrying about the past and future, you're just not using any brain power, so you don't need much rest. It just works naturally. Yesterday, you told the story of how the Buddha's teaching came from a previous Buddha. Why did this Buddha go unrecognized comparatively? And was this Buddha enlightened by a previous one? Ad infinitum. Yeah, that was Kassapa the Buddha, just a long time ago. And that's just the story, is that there's always more Buddhas. Life goes on round and round and round and round, no beginning, no end. And this is, you know, if it can happen, it does happen. So I always like telling this little story about the origin of the universe. I told this on my last retreat, because many religions, they wonder, how did this universe begin? Was it created by something? Or was it just some first cause, or it happened because it could happen? What the solution to one of the biggest religious problems? Where did this all come from? And to answer that question, I'm going to teach you some science and some history too. Many centuries ago, people on planet Earth thought this Earth was flat. And they thought if they sailed far enough, they would fall off the edge of Earth into what you don't know. But we are far more educated these days. We know this Earth is a sphere. It doesn't have any edges, no beginnings or end. It's a sphere. And so we're not flat earthers anymore. But then many people became flat spacers. They thought if you go far enough out into the cosmos, you'll come to the end of the universe. And I, as a young man, used to think, what happens at the end of the universe? Is there a brick wall which you can't climb over? Is there a fence with a sign on saying anyone who goes past this point gets shot or gets arrested, like in the government? Or is there just a hole in which you just disappear at the end of the universe? Has this universe got any edges to it? And if you know any science, if you watch the documentaries, you will know that this universe, it's got limited size. And it was like 14 billion light years wide, like basically a sphere. But it has no edges, no beginnings, no ends. This universe has got limited volume, but no edges to it. And how could that be? And a simile I was told at university was a simile of an ant crawling around a basketball. That ant goes round and round and round the basketball. If you're a Westerner or sort of outside of Australia, soccer ball, but a basketball, a round ball, goes round and round and round and round and round. And soon finds out there's a limited area, the basketball, but it's got no beginnings, no ends. That is like this universe. It is curved. So it doesn't have an end. If you go far enough in this universe, in a straight line, you come right back to where you started, just like the ant going around a soccer ball. And that is science. Every physicist understands that. The universe has got no edges, but it's curved, so it comes round upon itself. That is the nature of the universe in which we live. So we're not flat spaces anymore, we're curved spaces. Now, people are still flat timers. We think that time has an edge to it, a beginning and an end. But that is like flat earthers. Think if you go back far enough, you'll fall off the edge of time before the beginning. And maybe if you go long enough, you'll get to the end of time, where time stops and another brick wall. And of course, that has caused so many problems philosophically and religiously. If there's a beginning of this universe, basically a beginning of time, why was there a beginning of time? Who caused the beginning of time? What was before the beginning of time, if that question makes any sense, and it doesn't make any sense at all? Even the idea of a God. Well, what was before the God? How can anything begin the beginningless? So the answer is so simple. Why should time have an edge? Why should it have a beginning and an end? Because nothing else has a beginning and an end in this universe. Things just go round and round and round, like planet Earth. Like the universe, like time, is curved. It's not flat. Therefore, we don't need a God. We don't need a beginning. And that's exactly what the Buddha said. Beginningless time, going round and round. So now you have the answer to the question about God. Easy, isn't it? And you hear it all in Jhana Grove Meditation Center. Yesterday, that's the Buddha's teaching come from previous Buddha. Yeah, it just goes round and round and round. And that was Kassapa the Buddha. A previous Buddha also lived in the Indian subcontinent a long time ago. Now something else to blow your minds. Sometimes people ask, why have we got such a powerful Buddhist community here in the West? You don't have anything like this in Sydney or Melbourne or Brisbane. You don't have a thriving monks' monastery with so many monks and nuns' monastery and retreat center like this. Why is it so powerful over here? And there is a reason for this. And the reason is, and this is absolutely true, many tens, hundreds of thousands of years ago, this band of hills on which Jhana Grove Bodhinyana Monastery and Dharmasara Nuns Monastery is located. That was part of this big supercontinent called Gondwana Land. And it split, Gondwana Land split, right along this edge. And Australia went one way, and India went the other way. So this band of hills is geologically the same as the eastern coastline of India. We were connected to India many tens of thousands of years ago. And in those days, that was when the previous Buddha was practicing with Kassapa. In the time of the previous Buddha, this Western Australia was part of India. And the previous Buddha and his disciples would have walked on the land where now is Gidigadap and Jhana Grove and Dharmasara and Bodhinyana. That is science. Sort of. But the part of India and the West Australia being together, that's absolutely true. You know, ask any geologists and just these hills over here, same geology as East India. Please tell a story of two couples stuck in a boat middle of the ocean. I would like to see that story of no option, than following the path to get out of samsara, sadhu, sadhu, sadhu. Ah, oh, that was an old story. A couple of people, I know Janice was one of them. She's over in Toronto now, still supports the Buddhist Society. She's one of the directors of Tisarana, the Bhikkhuni monastery outside of Toronto. Fascinating. The monastery of our tradition in Canada. It's in Ontario. And guess what city in Ontario it's a part of? Perth. Perth, Ontario. And Perth, Western Australia. The two cities with these great monasteries. For monks as well as bhikkhunis. It's weird, isn't it? Or is it weird? Or is there something in this name of Perth? I just let him play with you. But anyway, she's the one of the directors over there. And she was here for a couple of years. Her husband was some geologist or something, doing some work with the mines up north, going to contract. A young couple, go to Australia for a couple of years, make a bit of money, and then go back to Canada. And when he finished his contract, they sold their little house. It wasn't worth that much, but it was enough in those days to buy a small yacht. Because they thought, instead of flying back to Canada, we're young, let's have an adventure. So they bought a small yacht, the two of them, to sail back, you know, all the way to Vancouver. And the plan was, when you get back there, sell the yacht, and you got your money for your next house. A really good deal, and it's an adventure for them. So they teamed up with another couple, I think also Canadians, going back. So the two couples, on an adventure, sailing through the South Pacific, visiting all the islands, taking their time, having a great time of their life. But, you know, because they were good friends, disciples, she still sends me a Christmas card every year. A Buddhist card every year. And when they arrived, you know, they sent me a letter saying they'd arrived safely. And she told this story that in the middle of the ocean, somewhere in the Pacific, which is huge, hundreds of miles from the nearest land, their yacht had engine failure. So they couldn't go anywhere. And in those days, it was the two women. They didn't know anything about engines. So they were sitting on deck reading magazines. And the two guys were in the engine room trying to fix up this engine. It was hot. It was cramped. And that engine didn't want to be fixed. And being in such cramped quarters, they started getting irritated at each other. And the irritation soon led to an argument. And the argument soon got so bad, one of the men, she didn't say who, threw down his wrench and said, "Right, that's it, I'm leaving." He actually said this. And he was so crazy with anger, he literally went into his cabin, washed and changed and packed his suitcase. And he appeared on the deck carrying his two suitcases. And only when the two girls started laughing their heads off did he realize his predicament. He looked around him and it was ocean in every direction as far as you could see. And only then he realized how stupid he was. There was no place to go. So he apparently went beetle red with embarrassment. And he turned around, went into his cabin, unpacked, put on his work clothes and went to help fix the engine. He had no choice. And of course, they fixed the engine and they remained really close friends and they arrived back together. They're close friends to this day. What a wonderful story that is. You can see what happens in marriage, relationships. Right, that's it, I'm leaving. I've had enough. You've been unfaithful to me. You spent too much. Rah, 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 rah. Can't stand you any longer. I'm leaving. But if you imagine you're in a boat in the middle of the ocean, there's nowhere to go. When there's nowhere to go, you've only got one choice. Stop thinking about leaving and fix up the problem. Just our modern world with terrorism or environmental problems, whatever problem there it is, there's no place to go. We are like that boat in the middle of the ocean called space. It's a waste of time getting angry at one another. Right, that's it, I'm leaving. There's no place to go. So we better start fixing things up. And you can. Doesn't matter how angry you are with your partner. You can always go back and help work out the problem. But if there's some place to go, you miss that wonderful opportunity. I've discovered that my natural breath is slightly rapid and shallow. Does this matter if you proceed deep meditation states? No, not of course. Whatever your breath wants to do, just let it do it, because after a while it vanishes. So it doesn't stop your meditation at all. Just go with the natural breath and soon it'll become quiet and peaceful. As you become more peaceful, the breath becomes more peaceful. And it just, this wonderful little cycle, breath is peaceful, therefore you're more peaceful, therefore the breath gets more peaceful, therefore you are more peaceful, until the breath disappears and then you disappear. So this is what happens, and it's a beautiful little process which happens. So it's natural, just leave it alone and everything will be fine. When we meditated, are we supposed to put the tip of our tongue touching the ceiling of our mouth? No, you can do whatever you want with your tongue. Let your tongue decide. Ask your tongue, where do you want to be? You know, when I'm talking, I don't give a damn what my tongue is doing. It just does it by itself. It's quite natural. When you go to sleep at night, do you say, I must put my tongue to the left part of the top? Of course you don't. You just go to sleep. So keep it normal, natural. Don't even worry. Whatever the tongue does, or if you really liked it, would be really good fun. When you meditate, stick the tongue out. Be a bit gross. I don't care what the tongue does. It does whatever it likes. So you don't have to put the tongue at the tip of your roof of your mouth. I know that some Mahayana teachers say that. That's just more Gomayang. Remember what Gomayang means? Very good. When I focus on my breath, I feel like I'm somehow controlling it, moving in and out. How can I tell the difference whether or not I'm controlling it? Any advice on how to avoid controlling it? Yeah, it is one of the things, when you first watch anything, you control it. I'll now prove that to you. Now be aware of the saliva in your mouth and throat. Now it's a problem, isn't it? I shouldn't have said that. Now I can feel it. Should I swallow? But then that doesn't get it away. But when you weren't paying attention to it, your saliva was fine. You swallow when you needed to. You weren't even aware of it. It all happened quite naturally. Whenever you watch something, you always tend to control it. That's the problem. So when you watch the breath, you will always tend to control it at first. But just keep on watching it and just keep letting go, and the breath would eventually settle down. Just the same when you first get married. You tend to control your partner. Even just going out, you tend to control each other. But after a while, you just let each other be because you realize your partner is totally out of control and so are you. So just get to learn that as soon as possible and then you have much more fun. So yeah, you do it, but just leave it alone, just carry on, be patient and the breath settles down by itself. But at first it will be a little bit unsettled. Heard any bad jokes lately? Can you tell us one? Okay, here's a very bad joke about the three indigenous kids, foot, foot, foot. You know this one, it's terrible, isn't it? Yeah. Well, that's what they wanted, a bad one. Okay. Up in a very remote indigenous community, way up north, a long way from anywhere, a mum had three sons. And the first one, according to their customs, was called Foot. And the younger brother was called Foot Foot. And had a third son. They wanted a girl, but it turned out to be a son. So they called the third son Foot Foot Foot. So when Foot got old, about 18, he'd been up in the bush all his life. He wanted to visit Perth to see what the city was like. So he asked his mum, can I go and visit the city? His mum said, no, it's a dangerous place. You lived all your life in the bush. You don't know what it's going to be like. But mum, I'm 18. And mum said, okay, but you take your younger brother, Foot Foot, to look after you, and then I'll feel a bit more happy. So Foot and Foot Foot got on the bus, and they went all the way to Perth. When they got there eventually, they got off the bus in the middle of the city, they were walking around, and Foot saw a discarded McDonald's hamburger on the ground. And he thought it was bush tucker, because in the bush you can eat anything on the ground and it's fine. But not in the city, he didn't realize that, it'd probably be dirty and infected with all sorts of bacteria. But Foot ate it anyway, it's delicious. But as soon as he ate it, he realized he made a big mistake. His stomach started to get very sick and he got some sort of infection. They took him to the hospital, but you know, he wasn't used to these bugs up in Perth, and he died. So Foot died, and Foot had to sort of ring up his mum, say Foot has died. He says, Foot here, but Foot has passed away. His mum was really upset, and they arranged to take the body back up to the indigenous community and do the funeral services for them. And after the funeral services were finished, and after a decent time, Foot told his mum, Mum, you know, I didn't have a chance to see Perth. I only went there for an hour or two, and my elder brother Foot, you know, he ate the hamburger. I promise, if you let me go there, I won't eat anything which I find on the ground. Can I please go to Perth, please? And I'll take my younger brother, Foot, with me. And his mum said, no, you can't go. But why, Mum? Because I've got one foot in the grave already. Does that qualify as bad? I think it does. That's a very bad joke. I've got one foot in the grave already. Anyway. Today I listen to some uplifting music on my headphones and dance in my room to lift my mood. Is that okay? If the music you listen to was the Metta Sutta by Ajahn Brahm, this is what should be done. How come nothing could be more uplifting than that? That would be okay. So, okay, you have a little bit of that. It is breaking the precepts, but if you give a bit of fun and games, that's okay, but don't do it too often. And please don't do walking meditation with your headphones on, because instead of lifting, you'll be dancing around and doing all sorts of stuff. Dear Ajahn, where should one put one's awareness when eating, shaving, brushing teeth, going to the toilet, etc.? When eating, you put it on the food, so you actually know what you're putting in your mouth, so don't put it on the plate next to you and think, oh, that looks nice, I'll have some of that. So you know what you're actually eating, put it, as I said, on the food which is in the mouth. And put the awareness there and chew that food, get all the saliva coming out, so then you have good digestion. Then you put all the attention on the food in your mouth, the taste. These people who come over here, they put so much energy and time and money into cooking the food for you. And what do you do? Bung it in your mouth and start thinking of something else, look through the window. You're not tasting their food. So taste it. And only when the last bit of taste is gone, then you can swallow it. And then you're aware of the next piece of food you need. So you put the attention on the eating. When you're in the toilet, put the attention on making sure the water goes in the right place. And sometimes people are so dirty when they use the toilet. And first of all, when you go to the toilet, the first thing you should be mindful of, if you go to the toilet, is there enough toilet paper? This is a public facility. So sometimes, how many times has that happened to you? You go and do a number two on the toilet, and only then do you think, the toilet paper, it's run out. Oh my God, what am I going to do? So be mindful that there's toilet paper there. Be mindful that you flush the toilet, you put the lid down afterwards, the right ways. If there's toilet paper is gone, please get some more for the next person. Be kind to everybody, don't make a mess. So that's what you'd be mindful of in toilet. Brushing the teeth, you'd be aware that you're brushing the teeth the right way. But if you want to be more aware in life, where do you start brushing your teeth from? Is it the top left, or the middle, or the bottom right? How do you brush your teeth? Now, if you always do it the same way, every time you brush your teeth, it just becomes a habit. There's no awareness there at all. So, I ask people, live on the wild side. Tomorrow morning, or this evening when you brush your teeth, brush it from a place in your mouth you've never brushed it before. If you always start in the corner, start in the middle. And just because you're doing something slightly different, you're much more aware. When it becomes a habit, there's no mindfulness, it's like you're dead. So even just brushing your teeth a different place, and maybe to be more mindful, don't do it with the same hand. Try the left hand brushing. Because one day you might injure your hand, one hand. And if you always brush your teeth with the right hand, when you have to brush it with the left hand, you will be incapable of doing that. So start now for the future. Brush it with the other hand and see what happens. Brushing the teeth can be great fun. Maybe. But anyway, just try doing it a different way. And shaving as well. Make sure you shave the right place. How can one remain joyful yet still at the same time? Oh, because stillness is the most joyful thing. Stillness rocks. And stillness, actually, there's so many different levels of stillness, and it's not at all boring. So you become still. You're not moving, but the stillness starts to develop. It's like planting a tree or planting a flower. You just planted it. You don't do anything more. And the flower starts to grow and bloom, and everything starts to happen. You're just sitting there. You're still. But it's amazing what things happen. It's just like going in the aircraft. You know, people say, you know, you travel to so many places. I don't go anywhere. I just sit down in my seat. It's the plane goes. I don't go anywhere. I don't move. So I sit down perfectly still in the aircraft. And I start off in Perth and I end up in San Francisco. I didn't move. The same with stillness. You don't move. And all these incredible experiences, they happen to you. And you're being perfectly still. And all the joy and the development of meditation are happening. You're still. But the world develops and moves. And you get incredibly peaceful. And stillness. There are so many incredible levels of stillness. This is, you know, true meditation. You get peaceful. And you think that's peaceful? No. The peace develops and you get incredibly peaceful. You think you can't get more peaceful than this. And it's just like climbing up these mountains. You see another peak just behind, which is even higher. And you take peace to its limit and you find it's even more peace. And it gets incredibly profound and an amazing journey to see how peaceful the world can be. And you haven't even scratched the surface yet. You get into meditation and it's really incredibly deep peace. The same with stillness. You think this is stillness? No. It's even deeper stillness where nothing moves, absolutely still. And it's more stillness than absolute stillness. It goes on like that. So this becomes an incredibly interesting journey in meditation. And then the bliss. This is one of the incredible things. Many people, someone said they had this, and I said, yeah, I remember when I had this. Sometimes you get so much bliss and pleasure. You think no human being can take so much pleasure. But then you find out you can. You can always take more bliss. And the bliss gets to its ultimate. You think there can't be any bliss more than this. And then you go to the next level of deep meditation. And it's more blissful than bliss. Are you interested? Yeah. I am. Anyway, it gets a fascinating part. Once you get into this, wow. I have found sitting out any pain in the body while remaining completely still seems to heal the body. Is this correct? Depends on what type of pain it is. Because sometimes people have a pain. One of my friends over in the north of England, when he was a young monk, he decided he was going to sit down and sit meditation all night without moving. When the pain came in his knees, he said, no, I am going to sit here. I'm going to fight the pain. And so he endured all this pain in his knees. And in the morning, we had to take him to the hospital. He had double knee reconstruction. It's craziness. You know, the pain is there telling you they're in a bad position. Most pain is like that. But there's other types of pains and irritations. You can actually feel there's some sort of healing, something that's actually working its way out of your body. And to know the difference between the different types of feelings and negative pain in the body is important. So there's some pain, you know, it's not really a destructive pain, it's like a healing pain. And that you can actually be with. So find the difference between the destructive pains and the healing pains. The healing pains, you know, you can feel there's something good happening. Follow the intuition, and it's a healing pain, but don't have these pains which you think you can control and beat down. Because you will never be able to. The pain will win. So that's why that we don't do anapanasati, anapanasati. We try and make the body nice and comfortable and get free from pain. A few months ago, I had a wondrous experience where everything I perceived seemed to appear in me. What does such an experience mean, and what can be gained from it? Okay, you go, like the journey in spirituality is go from multiplicity, where there's so many things, to oneness. But that's not the end. From oneness, you go to the next stage of noneness. One is only a stage in the journey. And it goes to nothing at all. Emptiness, where everything vanishes. Not one anymore, but none. That is why, I think before I went, where was it? Before I went to Japan, this Christian person came up to me that was trying to convert me and said, nothing is better than Jesus. And I said, yes, nothing is much better than your Jesus. And he said, that's not what I meant. I don't care, that's what I meant. So the great nothing, zero, is the best. But it's good, yeah, oneness is a really nice experience, but keep on going until everything vanishes. I'm finding it difficult to sustain my meditation sessions for much longer than 45 minutes at a time. Great, we'll just do 40 minutes. You don't have to. This is not the Olympic Games where I'm going to give a medal to the person who sits the longest. I thought we could do that, actually. Okay, everyone sitting down, okay, and we get a prize. The one who can sit still the longest without moving. Olympic Games meditation. You know, there's some people silly enough to enter things like that. Big egos. It's not the amount of time you meditate, it's the quality of the meditation, the peace, the happiness, the stillness. That's more important than the time. And Ajahn Chah's famous saying, he said, if the length of time you meditated was important for your enlightenment, the longer you meditated, the more likely you get enlightened. He said then, all the chickens in the world will be enlightened, because chickens can sit on their eggs for days at a time without moving. So we call people who meditate for 3 or 4 hours and try and beat their time, we call that chicken meditation. It's not Buddhist meditation. It doesn't matter about the amount of time. It is the quality of that meditation is important. And you'll find, don't try to do long sittings. Once the mind gets very still, the body relaxes, it happens naturally you sit for long periods of time. I don't know how many people, they come on these retreats, 30 minutes, 40 minutes, like the person said here. And then they get into a nice deep meditation, and they come to see me in the interview afterwards, Ajahn Brahm, incredible. I sat for 2.5 hours. I'd never sat more than 40 minutes before. It just happened. I was having a great time. It happens naturally. It doesn't, you can't force it. So when the mind gets peaceful, you're having such a wonderful time, you don't notice the time pass by. You haven't been asleep, you've just been really, really happy. Now, that is how to meditate long periods. It happens naturally, you don't force it. My monkey mind kind of demands a break at about something then. I am persisting, as you said, but I'm trying not to manage. This too much. Is this normal at this stage? What do I need to be doing? Should I just go with it? Yeah, just go with it. Let it develop naturally. It doesn't matter how much time you meditate for. So you meditate, and when you feel it's the right time to come out of meditation, come out of meditation. Do a bit of walking meditation if you want, or just have a cup of tea. Just go and watch the trees grow, or whatever it is you're doing. But it will happen naturally. You'll sit longer and longer and longer without any effort at all, because you enjoy it. How long can you watch a movie for? 2 hours? 3 hours? Does that take effort? Not at all, because you're enjoying it. This is what happens. You start enjoying the meditation, and it starts to sit long. But don't try. Dear Ajahn Brahm, you look like you have endless energy. Where do you get it from? Do you ever feel like sleeping in? Yeah, of course. But I take vitamins. I usually take 2 vitamins. You know what those vitamins are? Vitamin T and vitamin C, coffee. Now I use those to boost my, because I was born in England and I've seen it with other people. As soon as you're off your mother's milk, you're onto cups of tea. No. So just it's part of my blood. If you drain my blood, it's a bit browner than usual because it's got so much tea in it. It's just, what's your live on tea? That's why my master, my teacher, as soon as I heard there was a teacher called Ajahn Chah, that was a teacher for me. Thank you for the advice about getting plenty of sleep and rest. I have done that and feel quite rested. Great. I'm still struggling with the first talk you gave. Would it be possible to go through the important parts of the first talk? I feel unless I achieve this, to concentrate on my breath would be very hard. In fact, that is the case at the moment. I forget what the first talk was. It's all gone in the past. I let go of the past. You know, so basically, I forget what the first talk was. Just relax. Relax the body and then relax the mind. Simple. I think what I did say, which was quite important, was the Emperor's three questions. Now is the most important time. It's the only time you ever have. So forget about how long you're sitting for, how long has gone past. Now is the only time you ever have in this world. Doesn't matter how old you are, I'm 63 now, and just this moment feels exactly the same as it felt when I was 17. Now is all you ever have. So now is the only time you have, this moment. Everything else is just a fantasy and a dream. So it is important. And whatever is in front of you right now, this speech, this talk, you know, being with each other, this is really important. Never try and get rid of what you're experiencing now to try and get something better. This is the most important moment in your life. It doesn't matter what you're feeling. You're feeling sleepy. You've got a thought going through your head. It doesn't matter. It's important. You learn from it. And that way, now the most important time, this, whatever you experience, is the most important. That is the secret of mindfulness. You're aware of this, whatever it happens to be. Unfortunately, we're always so choosy. We want to get rid of this to get something else. You know, we're fed up with listening to Ajahn Brahm's bad jokes. I want to go to bed. We always want to be somewhere else. And that's why we never get enlightened. So whatever this is, give it importance. And of course, what do? We just care for this moment. And caring is not trying to change it. That's curing it. Caring for it is accepting it. This is what's happening right now, so you're at peace with it. When you try and change it, when you want something better, that's where you get your suffering from and frustration. When you care for this moment, there's no suffering left. You're not trying to change it, you're trying to learn from it and respect it. And that means that you get so peaceful. So that's the essence of meditation. Dear Ajahn Brahm, relaxing the body is easy for me. Used to self-hypnosis for many things. On my first meditation, I started to see bright, colorful things. Then a sky with nice clouds, and all became yellow, brighter than bright white. Then a very bright spotlight came to my eye and was so intense it blinded me, and I felt a burning sensation behind my right eye. Since then, I can hardly meditate. Is it going to come back? Oh, that's a trouble when people get nice things very early on. They've got nothing else to do for the rest of the retreat. No. It's very good. You felt it was blinding you, the bright spotlight, but you're not seeing this with your eye. Your eyes are closed. You're seeing this with your mind. This is a nimitta. I'll talk about this maybe tomorrow. What happens when the breath starts to get really peaceful and nice? What happens next? So this is what happens. You know, you're meditating, and then after a while, just you start to become very peaceful. The body vanished. And once the body vanishes and the breath vanishes, then you do start to see bright, colorful things in the mind. These are the nimittas. And it gets very, very bright. It doesn't blind you. You realize you're not seeing it with your eye. It can get even brighter, and you're fine. You can handle it. But fortunately, you thought it was actually seeing. And so you got the body awareness, and you got what you call a burning sensation behind my right eye. I'm sure your eye is perfectly healthy. Since then, you can hardly meditate because you got a bit scared. You don't need to be scared. These are beautiful states. You can enjoy them enormously. So the next time that happens, just relax and let go. Ajahn Brahm is here. You've got nothing to fear. It's true, because I know these things. Sometimes you think you're going blind until you realize you're not seeing it with your eye. You're seeing it with your mind, so you can take however much intensity you want. So that's great, but don't try and get it back. If you crave it back, you're not having any stillness. You just got to let go, as you did before, really relax, be really peaceful, and then these things come back to you. Could you please give more explanation of the Buddha's Buddha's three conditions to eating meat, as I understand it, so not to encourage the killing of animals to offer as alms. This is the things for monks and nuns, making sure that anything, fish, chicken, whatever, offered to the monks is not killed especially for them. Now, when I was a young monk in Thailand, we would eat anything which crawled on the ground because there was subsistence, frogs. I used to be a vegetarian before I was a monk, but when I ordained as a monk, you couldn't do that. Snails. That's what I hated, snails, because they were like eating erasers. They were just rubbery. And once, just for our one meal of the day, all we had was frog on rice. And one board of sticky rice and a frog on top. Boiled. No salt, no garlic, just boiled frog on top of sticky rice. And you've got no choice, that's what the villagers are. You've got the best frogs, because the villagers respected you. But even the best frogs weren't all that appetizing. But you had nothing else, so you had to eat your frog. And you started like every other monk in the line, started eating the legs, because it was like chicken, but that's not enough to keep you going for the day, so you start picking at its organs. But I was very lucky, because I knew one organ from another. I paid attention to biology. But the monk sitting next to me didn't. He didn't know one organ from another. So he pressed the frog's bladder. And it still had urine in it. And the frog peed all over his rice. Doesn't matter how hungry you are, you can't eat after that. So those are some of the water buffalo afterbirth. The placenta had ant soup. Ant eggs were very popular. And crickets, fried crickets. Yucky. So, but then it's about 3 or 4 days before Christmas. There was a Thai lady who had married an American. And he came along to visit us and said, I have a turkey farm. And maybe I can get you a turkey for Christmas. Now, a turkey tastes much better than boiled frog and snails. And so I actually thought, wow, we're going to get a turkey today for Christmas. And then he said, I'll choose one especially for you. And then we said, sorry, you can't do that. You can't kill one especially for the monks. So what do? We had frog for Christmas. So that's, we have to follow. If it's that especially for you, you can't do it. May also point out that India, being a largely vegetarian culture, is the complete opposite to Southeast Asia, that appears to be very addicted to meat and the origin of the Thai folk tradition. Could this culture not benefit karmically by not encouraging the killing or buying of dead animals to offer as alms? Your view, please. And lastly, one farming practice are so grossly incomparable to anything that proceeded with inconceivable pain and suffering to not only the animals but also those employed to carry out the inhuman practices. That, I'm sure, is imperative that it's not encouraged, but I found your vegetable joke to be in poor taste, pun intended. The taste. I told you I'd get into trouble, and actually somebody predicted I'd get into trouble with this. But yeah, we try our best, but sometimes we can't be perfect. So that's all we can do. But as a monk, that we don't have that much choice. You think, that monks have a lot of stuff on the table, but that's all we have. Sometimes I look even on all the food which people bring, and they think they're bringing food which we like, but sometimes they don't. They don't really pay too much attention to what the monks actually like and what they can eat, what they can't eat, so we try and do the best. It's one of the biggest sufferings of being a monk, is not getting what you like to eat. You just have to make do. You guys, even when you cook for yourselves, you have your recipes, you eat what you like. and you choose. And imagine you go to somebody else's house for lunch. You know, sometimes you don't get what you like, but at least you can have something for dinner. Our lunch, you've got one shot a day and that's it. So sometimes it's very difficult for monks. So because I was 9 years in Thailand, I would do eating anything. I wouldn't choose, even if it tasted absolutely disgusting. And that's, you know, pretty much wrecked my stomach. So there's so much food I can't eat these days. So sometimes people bring me food and I just can't eat it. I'll get sick. And I actually did that once. I was, you know, these days I'm very careful what I eat. And because what really turned me was once I was in Malaysia, in Kuala Lumpur, and I'd, you know, someone had given me something, and I didn't know what it was, but they went to all that trouble cooking it for me, so I just ate it. And when I was giving a talk, I threw up right in the middle of a talk, in front of 1,000 people. So I realized, you can't carry on like this, you've got to be a bit more careful. So that's one of the reasons why for monks it's so difficult being vegetarian. Because, you know, sometimes you don't get the vegetarian food you like, or you can eat, you can stomach. Especially because most of it is Asian food, and my stomach can't do Asian food. And look, we're Westerners, for goodness sake. So it's tough. So I do apologize if I can't sort of be a vegetarian myself, but I tried many times, I just can't do it because of the choice of food. If I was a layperson, if I disrobed, I probably would be a vegetarian. It would be no problem because I could select the food which I can eat. So that's one of the reasons why monks can't be. But we can encourage you guys, you choose your food. So please, you know, if you can, do it. But I also know some people, I met talking about this with a doctor over in Toronto, and he said he tried it a couple of times, but he just gets sick. Just can't do it. Some people can, some people just can't. So we're trying our very best, but there's a limit to what you can do. Anyway, this morning you said we should zoom in on the breath or meditation object. How do we do this without being a control freak? Thank you for your continuous loving kindness. It's just like a training, because it's just natural. When you focus on one thing, then if you start looking at me, the monk sitting next to me just disappears. It's out of your vision. It's not really controlling the mind. It's just a natural phenomena. You pay attention, you sustain attention on something, and it just goes in. There's a little bit of choosing when you choose the most beautiful object, but it's not the sense of always controlling, always wanting. It's just a little nudge here, a little nudge there, and that would work. Why does my mind just see or fill with colors when trying to meditate? Is that normal or a throwback from the 60s, etc.? You've been having all sorts of stuff. It depends when those colors come. If it's the beginning of the meditation, then it's just far too early. But when you're really getting peaceful and happy and you have some colors, then that's fine. But again, try the zooming in on the most beautiful color. Because when you see colors, there's always something which is the most beautiful. And just zoom in on that one. And you'll find that that becomes one of these very beautiful nimittas, the, you know, like the flashlight or the headlight. Again, I'll talk some more about that tomorrow. How can I meditate during a business meeting without missing aspects relevant for my work or without missing a question asked to me? How you can meditate during a business meeting is present moment awareness and be silent. So you're actually listening to everything which is being said and you're soaking it in. You're not trying to remember it. If you try to remember it, you tend to forget it. Your mind is too hard. Let go, relax, be silent. And then you can gather so much more information. Oftentimes in business meetings, you're going to speak next, you're trying to practice and think what you're going to say next, or you're arguing with the person who's just said something. So you're not really listening. So in a business meeting, you can do the first two stages of meditation, present moment awareness and silence. You're really aware. And then actually you can remember what people said, and you can understand what they said in silence. Imagine that you're also thinking when they're saying things. How can you really hear what they're saying when you're thinking something? It means your brain is divided from listening to what they're saying and listening to what you're thinking. And of course, you can't really get it all. So to be a communicator, you have to be a listener. to be a listener, learn present moment awareness and silence. So that's how to do it in a business meeting. During meditation, I have fears without feeling sad, or sometimes clear nasal discharge like tears. Is that a sign of the body as it is at its relaxed state? Tears without feeling sad, or clear nasal discharge like tears. It really depends. If those tears are happy tears, you feel lots of joy, that's a wonderful sign in meditation. It's a sign of joy and happiness coming up. But if it's, you know, just the fact of nasal discharge or tears, no particular reason, it's probably meaning you've drunk too much water and you're so full it's overflowing. So that's not a bad sign. But if it's sad, then it's obviously, you know, a little bit of negativity coming up. But if it's just happy tears, then go for it. Meditation is so hard. Can we have one or two sessions where we do guided meditation, please? Danny, did you get those guided meditations out on the computer somewhere? Yeah. Yeah, so that's where you can get the guided meditation from. And it's not hard. If you want to achieve something, if you're trying to get something, of course it's hard. The first day I talked about the second noble truth meditation, wanting something leads to suffering. So if it's hard, it's because you want something. So if you don't want things, you do third noble truth meditation, just content with your stupid old mind, with your old body. You're content with your body, with your mind. If you don't want anything, then your meditation is so easy. There is even the third Zen patriarch. He opened up a very famous Buddhist poem by saying, "The path is easy for those with no preferences, with no wants." So if you don't have any preferences, you don't want anything, the path is so easy, not hard. It's because you want something, that's why it becomes hard. Can you please explain why you have teddy bears in the meditation hall? Oh, thank you. That's to do, actually, teddy bear meditation. Can you pass one of the teddy bears to me? Or maybe, Silver, can you pass that one over there? That's a nice one. The other one is a bit big. So, teddy bear meditation. So, sometimes meditation is hard for you because you're not kind enough. You're trying too hard. So what you do with teddy meditation, take the teddy bear, put it in your lap, cuddle it. And when you're cuddling it, you just cuddle it like this, and then you close your eyes, and you feel your body, you feel the teddy bear, you relax. And you're just watching your breath with a nice little teddy bear. And you feel so happy. Just the teddy bear just, you know, brings you back to your childhood, nice and safe and secure. You're not trying to get things, you're just trying to be here. And it gives you that last little bit of kindness, compassion, softness, which makes the meditation really easy. So try it. It actually works. That's why they're here. Now I've told you, these teddy bears will disappear very quickly. Now, all these teddy bears we've had here over the years, they always change because people take them home with them and we have to get new ones. But they're really nice. Just even now you can cuddle them and meditate like this. This is beautiful posture. So this is what the teddy bears are to help your meditation. If you haven't tried it yet, try it. It really works. Honest. There we go. That's what the teddy bears are there for. Some gurus combine dancing, shouting, body exercises, even sex orgies with meditation. They say nowadays people first have to get rid of aggressions, tensions, before they should start with silent meditation. Any comments from your side? Yeah, you never actually get rid of the dancing, shouting, body exercises or sex orgies. You don't have to get rid of them, first of all. The more you do of them, the more you like them. And you never get to periods of silent meditation. Your whole life becomes with those. And this is actually something which actually the Buddha said, just by indulging, say, in sex, or in sex orgies or sensory pleasures, it doesn't get less, it just gets more. So even the Buddha said, this doesn't work. This was Osho, you know, Rajneesh was into this sort of stuff. Very popular but it doesn't work. So no, we have to have some restraint in life. When we restrain, we're letting go of things, we're not indulging in them. When we let go of things, actually then they start to vanish. It's just like, you know, can you overcome drugs by taking more drugs? The addiction gets even stronger. Can you just, you know, smoke so many cigarettes you're not going to smoke a cigarette again? No, you just, you know, keep on smoking more. There is many things in life, many addictions, we just have to, you know, learn how to say no to them. And the more we say no to them, just the more they just, they disappear from our repertoire. Just like people with anger problems. You know, you don't get rid of anger by, you know, shouting out at people. You just get into more trouble that way. You tend to restrain it. You understand it and then you let it go. You don't need it anymore. What is the story with the teddy bears? That's what he said. How come allowable food, 5 p.m., is just like the munchies' food? Why has the monastery's flagstone got 1987 to 2530, an end date? Yes, in 2530, we're all leaving the monastery. No, what 1987, 2530? That 2530 is the Buddhist age. It's a Buddhist calendar, which is 543 more than the Western calendar. Because some people say the Buddha's enlightenment was 543 BCE. So it's two, when this, the hall was made in 1987, that was 1987, you know, the common era, which is basically Christian. So we said, why not we put the Buddhist era there, which is 2530. It was always good fun when 2000 came in, YK2. Remember that, and everyone thought the world was going to end in 2000. And somebody asked me and I said, look, Buddhists, we were there 500 years ago, the Buddha never ends, so we've been through 2000, and it's fine. We're way ahead of you Christians. I'm just doing that to be cheeky. So please don't put a note there saying, why are you getting into the Christians again? That's just a joke, okay? An allowable food, 5 p.m., etc., is just like the munchies food. But you don't have to have the cheese and the chocolate or the sweeties or whatever else you have. It is just, we're supposed to be just eating in the evening, eating in the morning to keep the evening nice and free. But all these things are these just which manage to sneak through. You know, the cheese, because there wasn't any cheese in the time of the Buddha. So anything which wasn't disallowed becomes allowed. Basically, that's what it is. They didn't have chocolate then, so chocolate's allowed. So that's a nice sort of, you know, what's allowed. You just, whatever you want to eat, as long as it's not a meal. How do we understand doing versus being in terms of meditation and life? How do we apply these concepts in daily life? For instance, I feel a particular stress, pressure around money and making a living. Neither being nor doing seems to have worked so far. Is this due to karma? Yeah, when there's nothing to do, then do nothing. When there's something to do, give it everything you've got. That's a simple thing in life. The trouble is, we all know how to do things, but we don't know how to stop doing things. That's a problem in life. So, in life, around money, you know, if you haven't got any money, then don't do anything. Just relax. You can't go anywhere, you can't buy anything, you can't go shopping, so you can have a nice free day. Isn't it wonderful to have no money? And then you say, I can't go shopping. I can't go traveling. Woohoo! I can just sit in my house or your apartment and just have a wonderful time. But when you have money, then you've got all these responsibilities of buying something, upgrading, going traveling, doing all this stuff. Money causes so much trouble. Is that true, isn't it? Having too much spare money. So if you have a lot of spare money, it's going to cause you all sorts of problems about having to go to the shops and wondering what to buy. Then instead of that, you can put it all in the donation box and then you'll be free and so happy. Let it go box. Because the trouble is, it's too much money gives you too much choice. And sometimes choice is a great stress these days. You go in a supermarket. When I used to go shopping before I became a monk, you know, there's only one brand of muesli. And now there's organic muesli. There's Swiss muesli, there's Czechoslovakian muesli, there's muesli with this nut and that nut and lactose free and just you don't know which one to choose. You know, that's our modern life, too much choice. And it always reminds me of the bad joke of the person who came to Australia from a very, very poor country. I went into the supermarket for the first time, and he couldn't believe it when he saw instant mashed potatoes. You just add hot water and you get mashed potatoes. And he said, in the old country, we had to grow our potatoes. And we had to dig them up from the ground, scrub them, peel them, boil them, and then we can mash them. Here in Australia, just add hot water. This is incredible. And he went to another Ireland supermarket. So milk powder. You just add water, add hot water, and you got milk. He said, in the old country, we had to get the cow and milk it in the early morning, get up really early, get the bucket, and that's how we got our milk. In the West, you just get the powder and add water. It's incredible. And then he went to another aisle, and he couldn't believe his eyes. Baby powder. In the old country, we had to put it on. Okay, get the bad joke. So, being and doing in daily life. A lot of times, I mean, how much do you need to do to enjoy yourself? You know, you've all got really beautiful houses, many of you, all nice apartments. And what do you do when you have a holiday or a long weekend? Go away. What do you do that for? You spend so much money getting an apartment or a house, and as soon as you have the opportunity to enjoy it, you go somewhere else. You know, amazing just how we waste our money. Get a small house, downgrade. Just enough, you don't need two or three rooms. There was just one of the ladies that came in the other day, I mentioned, I just blessed her house last week, and she's got four bedrooms. What have you got four bedrooms for? You're by yourself. You're going to have three cats, or what are you going to do to have these four bedrooms, a dog in each room? But you know, one of the reasons is it's so hard, you know, through planning to get a small house. They don't allow small houses. And recently I read an article in, was in, I think, Washington, D.C. There were so many poor people there who were living out in the streets. They changed the planning laws to permit small houses. Because when they were small, they became affordable and more people could actually enter the housing market. So we're taking people off the streets. There's so many people actually could come off the streets of cities in Perth if we had small, therefore affordable housing. What do you want all the extra rooms for anyway? Just because everyone else has got one, that's why. And just no one room where everyone can sort of be in, just a couple of bedrooms, that's all, if you know you've got kids. You don't need a family room and a games room and a TV room and a spare room and a junk room and an entertainment room. I don't know how many rooms you've got. And you can only be in one room at a time. So small houses, it's really great for the environment. You don't use so much stuff digging out from the ground. It's cheaper, you can retire earlier because you don't have to spend all your time paying off a mortgage for parts of the house you'll never use. And it makes so much more sense. So that's why, you know, instead of doing so much, learn how to relax and be more. And then you can enjoy life. How can you deal with fear, for example, while meditating in a jungle or cave surrounded by dangerous animals like spiders and snakes, etc.? They say the spiders don't eat you. And the spiders are more afraid of you. More snakes have been killed by humans and humans by snakes. So it's the snakes who are scared, and that's so true. If a snake sees you, they go away first of all. And many snakes actually, they run away from you before you ever see them. So that's how you deal with fear, that what you're afraid of. And one thing I did know about fear, I'll answer the question, no more stories. So how you overcome fear is be rational. When, for example, okay, here's a story about fear. I was going to Singapore to give a series of talks during the SARS crisis. And the organizers had hired a big convention center, 5,000 seats for 4 nights. And that was right in the middle of the SARS crisis. I arrived at the airport and the delegation was there. Look, we're in trouble, should we cancel? Because the government had advised no big public gatherings. And they put so much money into this. A big 5,000 seat auditorium for 4 nights, and I was supposed to give the talk there. And so I asked them, I said, I saw the newspaper on the aircraft, 99 people had SARS in Singapore. And I asked the people, what's the population of Singapore? And they said, oh, well, it's about 4 million. So that means that 3,999,901 haven't got SARS. So it's about a 40,000 to 1 chance you're not going to get SARS. That's pretty good odds. You know, if it's 40,000 to 1, you're going to be safe. That's pretty good. So I said, let's do it. But when I put it that way, instead of saying how many people had SARS, how many people haven't got SARS? Instead of saying how many people get bitten by snakes living in the forest, in the jungle, how many people don't get bitten by snakes? After the London Underground bombings, how many people every year, you know, get killed by terrorist attacks? And how many people don't? When you actually see the numbers there, it takes away all your fear. Fear of flying. How many people from Malaysia are here? How many of you came on MH? You didn't. Air Asia? Ooh, no, not Air Asia. Ooh. But if you look, how many people actually die on aircraft crashes and explosions and stuff? It's safer. More people die in the car on the way to the airport than die in the aircraft crashes. Look at the figures. And that takes away all the fear. Fear, you know, if we actually see all the figures, we realize that we're being silly. Okay. You said to focus on breath, not on pain. In Vipassana meditation, they focus on everything that arises and the pain without moving the body. Isn't that also part of the Buddha's teachings? When should we use breath and when Vipassana meditation? There is no such thing as Vipassana meditation. That is a myth. Have a look at the suttas yourself. Even the Satipatthana, that is Anapanasati. In the 108th sutta, the Anapanasati, 118, Anapanasati sutta, it says anyone who practices Anapanasati fulfills the 4 Satipatthanas. And even my teacher used to say, Satipatthana, Vipassana, they always go together. You can't split them up. It's not we do one and then the other. The Vipassana tradition is a lot of gomayang. I'm sorry to say that, but it is. Okay, hee hee. We've got another one, Vipassana meditation. It's amazing how these questions all lump together. In Vipassana meditation, a meditation of knowledge, every input like seeing, hearing, smelling, etc. What should the meditation do if there are several inputs at the same time, like chatting crowd, lots of movement and anger inside, hunger and thirst? It's hard to acknowledge every single thing, indeed. So you stop acknowledging anything and you let go and allow things to disappear. So the Vipassana meditation, that's something which was developed a long time after the Buddha, and it's not original to the Buddha. The Buddha would do Anapanasati. You look for quotes on Vipassana in a meditation. There is no such thing as Vipassana meditation anywhere in the suttas. Vipassana, yes, not Vipassana meditation. And if you really want to see it, I'm just being quite quick here, so I'm being a bit fierce, so I apologize if I upset people. But if you look at the Gopakamogalana Sutta in the Majjhima Nikaya, where after the Buddha had just passed away, that people used to come to Ananda, you know, to ask, you know, what did the Buddha teach? Because Ananda had been with the Buddha 25 years and was the expert on the Buddha's teachings. And so someone said, what type of meditation did the Buddha recommend and praise? And the answer was, the Buddha only recommended, only praised 4 types of meditation. What were those 4 types of meditation? First jhana, second jhana, third jhana, fourth jhana. That's the meditation the Buddha praised. Jhanas, not Vipassana. Have a look yourself. Sometimes I feel spitefulness, even for people that are kind to me. What do? I don't want to feel like this. So look for where the spitefulness comes from. Why are you spiteful? A lot of times it's because you're not happy yourself and you get very spiteful that other people are happy. So if you can get your own happiness up, then you don't get so spiteful. And a quick way to get your happiness up, very quick, do the 10 push-ups in the morning, stand in front of the mirror, two fingers on either side of the mouth, one, two, three. And watch yourself as you're doing this. Straight away you get a laugh and you can't get upset at other people. When you're happy yourself, it's impossible to get angry and spiteful at others. So if you're spiteful, just get the nearest mirror and do 10 push-ups. When we breathe in peace and breathe out, let go, I find my head starts to drop and my body posture relaxes. Is that okay? Do we want to be mindful that our posture doesn't get too sloppy? Let the posture get sloppy if it wants to, because the body will straighten itself up if it really needs to. If the head drops, then let it drop. This is what the body needs. And later on, you find the body straightens up by itself. It's all automatic. Just what happens. How do I know if a thought, I mean the message in the thought, is important for me, or if it is just one of the thousands of thoughts that can be ignored? Sometimes thoughts, ideas can be very helpful for improvement or inventions. You're not going to invent anything here. And why do you want to improve yourself? You're good enough as it is. So all thoughts, just put in the bin. None of them are important. That's amazing. Just none of them. Because 99% of them aren't important. So it's much better to throw away the 99% and, you know, miss 1%, which might be useful, than actually to keep the 99% rubbish just in case one happens to be good. So throw them all away. And the best ideas come from silence, not from thinking. This is such a bad joke. Why did the toilet paper roll down the hill? Oh, okay, I get this now. Why did the toilet paper roll downhill? Answer, to get to the bottom. The bottom. And they say I say bad jokes. Compared to that, my jokes are very profound. Okay, last question. Can you explain death meditation and give an overview of other meditation methods Buddha taught? When to use which method? Death meditation. You will find that most people die when they're in their bed. So, in a few minutes' time, when you're in your bed, start to do death meditation. A lot of people, when they go to sleep at night, they don't wake up in the morning. Maybe this is your night. Who knows? Now, death meditation is realizing, you know, you're going to die anyway, so what's the point of, you know, worrying about stuff? Worrying about your taxes, worrying about, you know, your relationships, worrying about you're going to die anyway. It's so wonderful when people get told they're going to die. Now, this is, I'll tell you more about this tomorrow, but a last little nice story before you all go to bed at night. This one of my disciples, you know, he got very bad cancer, so I went to see him in the hospice at Murdoch, St. John of God Hospice. And when he got in, it's a beautiful place, you know, in that hospice. When he got in there, you know, the nurses, you know, said, "What do you want for dinner this evening?" He said, "Oh, well, I can't have this because I got cholesterol and diabetes and all this other stuff. So, you know, there's so much food I can't have." And the nurses said, "What do you mean you can't have this food? You're dying of cancer. The diabetes won't kill you. The cholesterol won't harm you. Now, the cancer's going to kill you. So you can eat whatever you like." I said, "Really?" He said, "Yeah, what do you want? Anything, grease, oily food, sugar, butter, you can have whatever you want." And he said, "This is the first time in about 3 years I can eat what I like." So he ordered all this greasy, sweet food with lots of oil and butter and everything which is supposed to be bad for your health. And he enjoyed it so much, and this is absolutely true, he got better and he left the hospice. It's absolutely true. Because just eating what he liked just improved his, you know, his mind. He was just so uplifted, so motivated, he started getting better, and his cancer got better. He went back again in 6 months to die properly, but he had six extra months you know, when he ate what he liked. So this is, you know, you can understand what goes on there. So, you know, without sort of eating what you like, you get so depressed. You know, I can't eat this and I can't eat that, and oh gee, I might as well die anyway, and life is no fun. But as soon as he started eating, you know, what he liked, he was so uplifted and motivated, you know, the mind was so bright and joyful, he started getting better. So death meditation, it's not just food or exercise which keeps you healthy. It's your mental state. Negativity, a lack of joy, a lack of happiness, that kills you, probably more than anything else. So don't just look after your, you know, your food or your exercise, look after your mind as well. Keep it positive, keep it happy. 10 push-ups every morning. And then you'll live a long, happy life and you won't die. But anyway, please don't die on this retreat. Because that will just cause so much bother for Dania and Bianca, and just having to arrange everything correctly. So that's just really very selfish if you decide to die on the retreat. So after the retreat, you can die whenever you like, but you know, not before Sunday. Okay, deal? So don't be selfish. Die afterwards, not during the retreat. Thank you very much. Good night. And so.